they're involved as well. So I just want to say that this tour has been put on by these groups entirely not funded by external sources. So we've gone non-funded by unions or business interests at all or any non-profits. So it's all out of our own pocket. So I'm going to pass around a can if you have any spare lint. Enough to even like keep us warm to drive to the next stop. That would be fantastic. Yeah, if not, don't sweat. Without further ado as well, I'll introduce our speaker, Jérôme Bazin.
Great to be in Saskatoon this evening. My name is Jérôme. I'm currently a worker at the Montreal Cégep. Just for the record, the Cégeps are a Collège d'enseignement général et professionnel. I'm going to be talking about those a little bit more during the conference. They're two-year mandatory colleges in between high school and university. So that's good to know. I was involved in student politics since 2004, at first on the executive board of my student association in Montreal again. And afterwards, I was also a member of the strike coordination committee of SC, which is a student organization I'm going to also touch on during the conference. Afterwards, I was also an anarchist activist. I was a member of NEFAC when I was president in Quebec, the Northeastern Federation of Anarcho-Communists, and as well afterwards of Union Communiste Libertaire, which is also an anarchist communist group in Quebec. In 2012, during the student strike, I was involved through my local student union as a part-time student at Université de Montréal. And I also took on various non-official capacities as organizer for different actions and different things. Since the month of May, I've also been involved in my neighborhood's popular assembly, born out sort of the Pots and Pans movement. So I've also been doing some organizing around that stuff. So this Quebec student movement, of course, as we know, has written a pretty important chapter in its history. The strike that was launched back in February turned out into one of the largest social movements in Quebec's history, perhaps actually in Canada's also entire history. Of course, one of the interesting side effects of the events of the last few months in Quebec has been that news of the strike has spread outside the province of Quebec, and many students and activists have taken notice. We're not only happy that our struggle has inspired hope among the left about our ability to fight back in this difficult context of austerity and where business leaders and business interests seem to ring virtually unchallenged, but we're especially happy to notice that the strike has sparked debates outside of Quebec about charting a way forward for the student movement and social movements in general. Our hope through organizing this speaking tour is that we can perhaps bring some meaningful insights into this discussion about rethinking about social movements. The talk I've prepared for this tour is divided in three parts. The first part, I'll talk a lot about the history of the Quebec student movement. And afterwards, I'll speak about the ideas and practices of something that's called combative unionism, that is sort of a tendency inside the student movement, and one I think that's been very largely behind the power of the strike that we saw this spring. And I'll also speak about how this history and how these ideas about how we can do student unionism are translated really on the ground during the strike in Quebec. The talk is about an hour long, perhaps a bit longer, so that's how long I'll be speaking. If anyone has perhaps a question, you can raise your hand, we'll try and address it. Otherwise, we can have, I do hope people stick around, we can have discussion and QA after all this. Actually, no, not yet. So the strike in Quebec didn't happen because we just do things differently. it didn't happen, I think, because there's anything inherently combative or collective about Francophone culture. If we want to help students and activists outside Quebec learn from that movement, I think we need to start by addressing the fog of Quebec exceptionalism. One way we've chosen to do that through this speaking tour is talk about history. It's an interesting starting point right there, I think, because we have something in common already. We're all surrounded by histories of kings, queens, conquest, statesmanship, the elite's history, basically. Quebec isn't any different at all in that respect. The history of popular movements and popular resistance is overlooked unless it plays into the nationalist narrative of the dominant political discourse. What the Quebecois student movement does have is a very rich history and tradition of sharing the history of student struggles. When I started getting involved in my Cégep student union in Montreal, I remember our union had a room dedicated to archives where you could find newspaper clippings, notes, photographs, reports, all things that were testaments of the struggles of the student activists that came before us. It was very hard not to spend a little bit of time in that room and not feel a very important attachment to all that history. Of course, that room was a complete mess, and it was virtually impossible to find anything specific, but that's perhaps for a story for another time. The birth of the student movement can be traced back to the mid-40s, not in Quebec, but actually in France. At the outset of World War II, a number of students, some with links to the anti-fascist resistance, want to give a new direction to the student organizations at the time. The apolitical and corporatist attitudes of student organizations that were present in France at the time gave rise to some ambiguous and weird relationships with the Nazi occupiers. And so as a response, students took on the task of building a new kind of student union modeled after labor unions. In 1946, the National Union of French Students, or UNEF by its French acronym, adopts a very important founding document, which is called the Charter of Student Syndicalism, which is later known most widely by the name Charte de Grenoble, after the name of the city where it's adopted. What's special about that document is that it defines the student in a new way. It defines him or her as a young intellectual worker with specific rights and responsibilities which ensue from this particular status. For example, Article 4, as a worker, the student has a right to work and rest in the best of conditions and in material independence, both social and personal, guaranteed by the free exercise of syndicalist rights. Article 7, as an intellectual, the student has a responsibility to seek out, propagate, and defend truth, which entails sharing and advancing culture, as well as drawing the meaning of history, to defend liberty against all oppression, which constitutes for the intellectual his most sacred mission. In his beginnings, French student syndicalism takes off around real concrete issues of decolonization and the Cold War. The students involved in the movement who uphold apolitical student groups are confronted. Back in Quebec, the notion of student syndicalism doesn't really catch on until the early 60s. At the time, student associations are very apolitical and center mostly around providing basic services and organizing parties. But in 1961, students at Université de Montréal, wanting to break from that tradition and write their own charter of the student rights and responsibilities inspired from the Charte de Grenoble. It's a new sort of ideological paradigm. Students as young intellectual workers develop a new awareness of their role in society as a whole. They're no longer content to concern themselves only with student issues. They start getting involved in worker struggles and identifying with the working class. As a result, more and more student activists subscribe to the idea of building student unions that can not only provide services to the student body, but also organize and lead struggles which can have an active role in shaping society. At the time, society in Quebec is going through rapid secularization. Education system, which was previously under the very tight control of religious authorities, is gradually going into the hands of the state. But the old authoritarian reflexes of administrators and faculty weigh down on the students' new sense of duty and responsibility. They want to participate in the important decisions that affect their education and their institutions. The watchword becomes student power. Another important factor to understand is that there's also only one Francophone university in Montreal, the Université de Montréal. It's elitist, it's expensive, and being perched up high on Mount Royal on Montreal Island, it's very far removed from French-speaking working-class boroughs in the city. So, combining with the fact that there's two very prestigious universities in Montreal already, Concordia and McGill, that caters to the smaller English community, English-speaking community, there's a sentiment of injustice that gradually grows stronger among students. So around this fight to democratize higher education, students coalesce around new militant student unions that helps drive the syndicalist tendency in the student movement. Combined, of course, with the general uproar in feminist labor and national struggles in broader society, the student movement quickly becomes a force to be reckoned with. In 1964, conscious of the need to coordinate the struggle, conscious of the need to build the financial and organizational tools that required to maintain a permanent balance of power vis-à-vis the state, syndicalist students create the Union Générale des Étudiants du Québec, or General Union of Quebec Students, UGEC by its French acronym. Just a few years later, in 1968, as major student protests inflame Europe, the upheaval crosses the Atlantic and reaches Quebec and other provinces in Canada. In Quebec specifically, a huge wave of turmoil sweeps across the province, and the fledgling student movement steps in with the first unlimited general strike of its history. Even though in the aftermath of that strike, the Quebec government creates a new public Francophone university in Montreal, UQAM, as well as the Université du Québec network, which gradually starts establishing campuses, university campuses in regions in Quebec outside of urban centers, as well also as a brand new student financial aid program. And the strike action is perceived as a failure. It's being perceived that way because it didn't come close to expectations. Even though the revolt spread across the countries and continents and even started to look like a full-out revolution in a few places, the social outburst eventually died down. That sentiment was shared pretty widely among student activists, and that was about to have pretty important consequences. In the following years, many local student unions were disbanded, including UGEC, whose membership was based on these militant student unions. It's not that students were massively abandoning any form of struggle, but because they saw student unions as simply too bureaucratic. They felt unions held back the potential for student radicalization. In disbanding student unions and reorganizing in smaller, more radical political groups, the students at that time hoped to build a truly revolutionary movement. Even though the critics about the student unions weren't entirely baseless, the decision to kill off student unions was made rashly and without much hindsight. Unsurprisingly, the loss of the only structures that could mobilize a mass movement led to a collapse of the student movement. As an added consequence, whole areas of student life on campus, which were previously built by student unions and were under the direct control of student unions, went into the hands of administrations. Obviously, not everyone in the student movement saw this in a very positive light. It sparked a big debate about which methods of organizations were most important and interesting for the student movement. In 1974, the government of Quebec announces plans to introduce in-university entry tests for Francophone students. In response, a coordination of syndicalist student unions start organizing for a new general strike. But the Liberal government wants to prevent any recurrence of the events of 1968, especially on an issue itself doesn't consider very important. Difficult negotiations with public sector unions make the perspective of a new confrontation with student unions and unions somewhat less appealing. So it quietly retires its plans to introduce these entry tests before the students get very far ahead in preparing that general strike. Since the government's reversal is announced as being only temporary, students decide to press on. The feeling of empowerment from that easy victory inspires them to even expand on the platform of student demands to include improvements on financial aid issues. The strike then gets going with just a handful of student unions at first, but it quickly gets much larger. In total, 40 institutions and university departments join in. And 4 weeks into the strike, the government announces an important set of concessions, and the strike comes to an end. The success of that strike leads the next year, in 1975, to the creation of ANIC, a new permanent and Quebec-wide student union. The Association Nationale des Étudiants Français, or National Association of Quebec Students. As you can imagine, for the next 20 years, the debate between affinity groups, which I've spoken about, and student unions was more or less put to rest. Instead, a more serious challenge eventually emerges from the right, but I'll just get to that later. By the time of the next large student mobilization in Quebec in 1978, ANEC eventually grows not only into the main student union, but in fact the only Quebec-wide student union and quite literally representative of the entire student movement. More importantly, however, it remains really true to its origins by actively promoting and developing rank-and-file control of student unions, as well as its commitment to combative militancy. But it's not all fun and games, however, with the election of the Parti Québécois 2 years later in 1976. Why is that? Well, the Parti Québécois is a pretty progressive party at the time. It fancies itself almost as a workers' party. Most importantly for the student movement, it's a political platform, promises to abolish student debt, enact free tuition, and even to implement a student pre-salary program. It's no surprise, though, that it has these elements in its program. Lots of ANEC activists, students who were involved in the 1968 strike in 1974, are very involved in the PQ. The election of the party to the government creates a huge wave of enthusiasm among the entire left in Quebec. But can you guess what happens to the party's progressive platform once it's in government? Well, it's shelved. 2 years later, by 1978, there's a rift inside ANEC. On one hand, you have the more radical activists who want to start organizing, building up a new general strike of students to try and force the PQ to implement its own program in education. While on the other hand, you have lots of activists also who are much more loyal to the party, and which defend a much more conciliatory stance towards the government, hoping to make progress by way of negotiation and dialogue with the government. Though both factions are about equals in numbers within ANEC, the radicals, mostly based in CEGEP student unions, eventually win a crucial leadership election in the organization. Just a few days later, a rural CEGEP launches the strike, and with the demand, of course, of the PQ's own promises in matters of accessibility to higher education. And the strike gradually expands, though not as previously as fast as the previous one. After about 3 weeks, 30 CEGEPs and a handful of university departments are on strike. As the mobilization seems dying down, though, students of UQAM, which is a very large student union in Montreal, steps in and joins the general strike. Again, during that student strike, the government's forced into concessions. After two distinct announcements on improvements to the student financial aid, the strike ends. But as students start to start going back to class, ANEC activists decide to press on and organize campaigns of occupations of MP offices. And that year, in 1978, in a single day, six MP offices are occupied simultaneously. With the positive results from general strike, a renewed feeling of empowerment helps consolidate ANEC's radical leadership. It'll remain a symbol, really, of radicalism and mass mobilization until its very end. Advocates of conciliation and negotiations will have eventually to form their own separate organizations. That happens in 1981, when Raer and Faik are born. As brainchilds of PQ activists whose party holds power, the new student unions are rapidly integrated into the state's apparatus. Amazingly, they're also hostile to any form of mass mobilizing of students. Their rallying cry is, really, at the time, the strike never again. The 80s opens somewhat of a gloomier chapter in the history, not simply of the student movement, but for the left in general. It's the era of the post-referendum, a crisis inside the Parti Québécois, the worst economic recession since the Great Depression, the dissolution of many revolutionary groups, and difficult battles between the labor movement and the PQ's René Lévesque government. On the international level, Reagan and Thatcher usher in the new era of neoliberalism, the welfare state's on its way out, and new policies of privatization and the massive cuts in social spending become the order of the day. In Quebec, the Liberal Party succeeds to the PQ in 1985. Under pressure from their own youth wing, however, they still promise to maintain the tuition fee freeze, and because university tuition fees are still frozen at their 1968 levels after a promise that helped end the strike that year. Of course, the regime change is bad news for Raer and Faik, whose bodies are entirely controlled and supported by PQ activists, so both organizations eventually collapse into irrelevance. The next year, 1986, the education minister declares that the tuition freeze has to be abandoned, and going as far as saying it that there's twice too many university students in Quebec. ANEC, a few months later, after a campaign of general assemblies and a 5,000-strong demonstration on Parliament Hill, a new general strike is launched. The main demands, which are discussed and adopted in general assemblies across student unions and adopted in a congress of ANEC member unions as well as non-member unions, are to force the government to promise to maintain the freeze on tuition fees, to dump also university ancillary fees, and again, for improvements to student financial aid. Just 2 weeks into the strike, in which about 25 student unions participate, the education minister comes out with a promise to actually maintain the tuition fee freeze, at least until the next election. Promises also to abandon temporarily ancillary fees at the large UQAM university. And on the issue of student financial aid, he promises a series of meetings with student delegates in which the demands would be considered. While the student unions decide to stop the strike, at least temporarily, a number of occupations of government buildings are organized in the following weeks to keep up the pressure. Months go by and negotiations and the negotiation meetings promised by the government don't produce any results for students. So as a result, ANEC launches a call for a new general strike to try to materialize their demands for improvements to new improvements to student financial aid. Unfortunately, the strike attempt in 1988 never takes off. The Liberal Party goes on to be re-elected, and in 1990, they officially announced the famous tuition fee hike, bringing them from $500 a year to more than $1,200. At the same time, it gives universities in Quebec the ability to increase these fees by up to 10% as they see fit. Once again, in 1990, student unions set off plans for a general strike. During the strike campaign, the government hammers its justification for hiking the fees by saying, of course, that improvements to student financial aid, which means in that case bigger loans and more student debt, would compensate for the effects of the hike on poor students. At the same time, the student right gets organized. A group of Cégep student unions opposed to the strike that year formed the FEC, Fédération étudiante collégiale du Québec, and allied themselves with a new university student federation, the FEUQ, the Fédération étudiante universitaire du Québec. As successors directly of the pro-PQ RAEU and FAEC, the two organizations promote an essentially a lobbyist strategy for the student movement. Their hostility to mass mobilization marks again a new break with the student movement's legacy of syndicalism. Unfortunately, the 1990 attempt to block the hike ends up in a big failure. 3 years later, pulled down by intense internal strife, ANEC will be disbanded. For the next 6 years, FEC and FERC will have pretty much free rein over the student movement in Quebec, allowing them ample time and space to enroll a sizable chunk of Cégep and university student unions. The student left will only get reorganized around opposition to the federal Axworthy reforms in 1994. Those reforms would see provincial transfers in matters of health and education slashed. Common initiatives at the time between a few local student unions, organizing of a protest, a large mobilization committee, as well as a radical student newspaper, eventually leads to the formation of the Mouvement pour le droit à l'éducation, or Movement for the Right to Education. So in 1996, Pauline Marois, which you might have heard of, and who is now elected as Prime Minister of Quebec, recently elected. She's the education minister at the time in the province. In 1996, she announces a hike in university tuition fees and Cégep ancillary fees. The MDS spearheads that year a general strike movement in which unions affiliated with FEC and FERC eventually join in. After about 3 weeks of the striking, Marois announces she'll scrap the university tuition hike, but with a catch. She'll implement a new failure tax on Cégep students, which would see Cégep students have to pay special fees when they fail classes, and the failure of paying for these fees would prevent them from continuing their studies. And most importantly, that measure is proposed to her by the leadership of the FEC. The move, of course, is immediately considered as treason by the rank and file and the radical activists who built the mobilization that stopped the hike in tuition fees that year. A lot of people are convinced that the strength of the mobilization could have gotten rid of the hike and that the trade-off that was made was a move deliberately made to have the strike abort very quickly and allow the FEC to bolster its standing in the eyes of the government. Even though this bittersweet victory consolidates the motivations of student activists to keep on organizing within the student movement, the MDA has somewhat a difficult time escaping marginality and gaining a significant membership. It eventually dies off in the year 2000. However, despite its relatively small membership, the MDA kept alive radical ideas and practices in the student movement. Its whole existence to rely on the need to distrust leaders, on rank-and-file syndicalism, and on direct action. For example, following the 1996 strike and the FEC-FERC sell-out agreements, the MDA will continue to organize protests, occupations, demanding a substantial increase in the minimum wage, a 32-hour work week, as well as free and quality health and education systems. As such, the MDA continued to preserve combative syndicalism in the student movement and opposed the FEC-FERC's lobbyist corporatism. So the perspective that the FEC and FERC will once again dominate the student movement, and that it will gradually distance itself from its heritage of it as a democratic and combative force, is a bit too much for lots of activists involved in the 1996 strike, as well as in the anti-globalization movement at the turn of the century. So in the hopes of helping the student movement return to its former glory, in 2001, several historically radical student unions in Quebec decide to unite under the banner of Association pour une solidarité syndicale, or Association for Solidarity Among Student Unions. Incidentally, assez is a French play on words for that means enough. Okay, allow me to just step back and say a few things about all the history that I've covered. I've told you about the birth of the student movement, 1968, the first syndicalist student unions, the battles of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But really what I've explained so far about all this is really just skimming the history. A number of historians in Quebec have done really interesting research into all of these events and have written work specifically on the student movement, of course with much more details and with broader context. Unfortunately, while researching for the speaking tour, I haven't come across any of these works that were translated in English, so I apologize if you don't find any of those on our literature table. The ideas I've said...
Question, you were talking about the history, so before we move on. You remember when you're talking back in 78, the occupation by ANEC of the MP offices?
Yep.
I was surprised to hear about that strategy, since the funding for education and the decisions about universities always come to the provinces. Do you know how that strategy was made? And it seemed like the battles between the student movement and the people they were battling against always seemed to be provincial officials. Do you know how the occupation of the MP offices came to play?
Yeah, well, when I'm talking about MP offices, of course I'm talking about Quebec province, Quebec National Assembly MP offices. So, of course, I haven't heard much about occupation of federal MP offices. So, yeah, it's a precision I didn't make, unfortunately. But yeah, it's federals were left mostly because anyways, at the time, people felt, well, just a matter of time since, well, like, these people will just be kicked out. So for sure, the battles between the student movement and the government was really waged between the provincial government. So the idea, as I've said in the beginning, is to give a feel for where the strike comes from. I hope that already by now it's clear that there's more to the student strike this spring in Quebec than just mere spontaneity. I want to highlight also that every student strike in the province has been a major turning point also in the organizations of and development of the student movement. After 68, student unions were destroyed. One in 74 gave rise to ANEC. In 78, we saw a rift between radical and lobbyist student activists. After the success of 1986, the lobbyists lost ground, and the failure of 88 divided ANEC, and the aftermath of the last failed strike in 1990 helped lobbyist student federations establish themselves permanently among the student movement. Quebec's student movement, as it exists today, was essentially shaped by mass, collective, and syndicalist-type politics and action. Another point I want to make is that the student movement in Quebec is not homogeneous, far from it. The vast general strike that we saw this spring gave an impression of a united front between the three main organizations that exist today, ASTE, FEC, and FERC. But underneath the media hype and the relationship between these three organizations is a lot more complex and even caustic, I would say, than images of unitary student protests led on. But we're not talking about parochial conflict here. It's a question of fundamental disagreements on both elements of practices and political outlook. But before I get into that, I want to speak a little bit more about ASTE's own history. ASTE is the Quebec-wide student union that formed the CLASS, which you might have heard from, by opening its committees and congresses up to unaffiliated student unions so they could join temporarily during the campaign against the latest tuition fee hike. Those who might have followed the strike more closely know that class is the main force and the main, perhaps, protagonist between of that struggle. Getting an understanding of ASSE is key, I think, in better understanding the origins of the strike. So on with 2001. The failure tax, which is inherited by dealings of the FEC and the governments during the 1996 strike, it's taking its toll on college students. A coalition of unaffiliated local student unions form around the project to launch an opposition movement and have the tax abolished. Here, a few things start working in the favor of creating a new Quebec-wide syndicalist student union. First, it quickly becomes obvious how working outside the structures of a formal organization weighs down on the efforts of the student activists and the organizing efforts of that campaign. How are the costs to be shared? How can the different student unions pool their resources into that campaign? And who or what will track the general progress of things in between the different meetings? A second, while the student unions are able, that they'll be able to stir up a sizable opposition movement to the failure tax because it's really hated among students at the time. There's specific concern regarding the FEC. As the group, the student group that agreed to the failure tax in the first place, there's worry that it'll appropriate the opposition movement as its own and use that to negotiate another rotten outcome against the wishes of the rank and file. Eventually, those preoccupations are confirmed when the FEC, who isn't taking part in mobilizing at all, negotiates with the government student performance contracts, which would be another form of punishment for students who fail classes and would prevent them from again continuing their studies for a certain amount of time if they break it. And that in exchange for dumping the failure tax. Outside the student movement, there's the broader political context I want to talk about. In the 1990s, the first half of the decade is dominated by the question of sovereignty leading up to the 1995 referendum in Quebec. But it's really the second half of that decade that sets the tone. The PQ's obsession with a zero deficit results in cuts of nearly $2 billion in education alone. In 2000, during a Quebec Youth Summit, the government agrees to re-inject some funds into education, but under strict conditions of implementing a series of reforms inspired by neoliberal and free market policies. That plan is baptized Plan Legault after the PQ Minister of Education at the time. On a global level, negotiations by states for a multitude of international trade agreements on capital and services points to a new era in the globalization of capitalism. Reports and investigations into these negotiations reveals how far states are ready to go to empower capital against people. At the same time, the WTO summit in Seattle reveals the extent of the potential for popular resistance. Similar events happened in Washington, Genoa, and also in Quebec City with the now famous Summit of the Americas in 2001. ASSE's first activists are really immersed in that anti-globalization movement. In the first months of its existence, ASSE renames its campaign against Plan Legault as a campaign against the steering of education by market laws. In doing so, it manifests a rejection of narrow and piecemeal understanding of state education policies. Instead, by highlighting the role of market laws, it seeks to tie together the various great number of reforms being implemented in CEGEPs and universities across the province. And it also wants to link these reforms with the wider dynamics of international trade agreements and capitalist globalization. Even though it's off to a good start, that campaign eventually runs out of steam. Remember, at this point, ASSE is rather small, with only about a dozen member student unions. ASEA then decides to focus on the North American Free Trade Agreement. That campaign rallies students from across the sectors of the student movement. And as it does, it forces even the student federations, FEC and FERC, to respond with their own campaign surrounding NAFTA. But they can't bring themselves to rally behind a radical anti-NAFTA agenda, so they respond with their own different campaign of a corporatist and responsible demand of no to the inclusion of education in NAFTA. At a large meeting of student unions from across or affiliations, only a tiny fraction decide to get behind the Federation's campaign, while the vast majority of student unions will rally behind ASEA and its anti-NAFTA campaign. On October 31st, 2002, 10,000 people marched in Montreal in clear rejection of NAFTA. So, in the first few years of its existence, its struggles are about global dynamics on which the student movement at large has very little grab. The fight against NAFTA isn't able to spark a movement outside the student movement. And while the 2003 anti-war movement during the war on Iraq has a certain popular character from its inceptions, student unions aren't able to really highlight any specific political goals they can really work towards and make progress on. And when it tackles the steering of education by market laws, it's campaigning against nothing less than the vast neoliberal restructuring of education, which is at the same time really quickly becoming facts in CEGEPs and universities across the province. Nonetheless, ASEA is still able to build a base of support among students. And in the context of wide opposition to international summits, NAFTA, WTO, G8, G20, the student body responds enthusiastically to calls for mobilization. Through the experience of these first struggles, ASEA's activists are able to develop an open political vision and a deeper understanding of student issues. A new frame of thinking makes its way into the student movement. That the roots of our day-to-day problems, including in education, can be found in the international economy, and more specifically, in the relationship that builds between human populations and capital. In 2003, however, the focus goes from international to local with the election of a new Liberal government and its plans for state re-engineering. It's a shock for the labor and community groups who are used to the PQ's smooth approach of dialogue and consultation. The Liberals, on their part, waste no time in implementing anti-social reforms, including in education. ASEA puts out a call for a new general student strike in 2003 against a hike in university ancillary fees. But that campaign ultimately fails in getting more than just a handful of student unions on board. The lessons learned from that campaign eventually come in handy when the next year, in 2004, the government announces a reform of student financial aid, converting $103 million of student bursaries into loans. ASEA reacts by organizing a wide consultation of General Assemblies in order to build a platform of demands and start building up a momentum towards strike action. Tours of CEGEPs and universities are organized, as well as massive distribution of material calling for the strike and demonstrations and occupations. Because it's conscious also that a successful strike movement would necessarily have to include other student unions than its own membership, ASEA begins planning for a strike coalition. The student federations, on their part, adopt a wait-and-see approach to the strike. While ASEA activists are busy mobilizing students on campuses across the province, FEC and FERC are content with representing student interests at Liberal Party gatherings and the Generations Summit organized by the government that year. To add insult to injury, the day the general strike is launched in February 2005, they go on the record declaring that it wasn't the appropriate time for a student mobilization and that they had no plans at all to join the strike action. In fact, since the education minister has been replaced a few weeks earlier, the student federations want to give him a chance. Well, hopefully the student movement itself doesn't concur. Within 2 weeks, over 70,000 students are on strike in Quebec, and including some student unions affiliated with FEC and FERC. The two federations are eventually forced to join the strike or risk having some serious representation issues. That about-face turns out to be a mixed blessing. While the strike keeps on expanding in the following weeks, the issue of negotiations come up. After one meeting with the ASSE Strike Coalition Negotiations Committee, the education minister declares that he won't pursue any further negotiations before the student group renounces, quote, violence, unquote. Of course, what he wants the student movement to abandon are, in fact, occupations of offices, rowdy protests, and blockades. In other words, the only tools at the disposal of students to effectively disrupt business as usual and force the government into negotiations. For sure, the issue will create lots of debate in student general assemblies and meetings of the strike coalition. But in the end, in part, I think, because of the involvement of anarchists and radical activists, the coalition eventually, through several decisions in their general assemblies, it decides to maintain its commitment to combative militancy. The student federations, on the other hand, immediately renounce violence and begin close negotiations with the government. At that time, the strike coalition around ASSE represents about a third of the striking students and also the longest striking unions. So the move creates a lot of discontent, even among the rank and file of the student federations, who eventually launch a plea with their own leadership to stop and break off negotiations while delegates from the strike coalition are excluded from the negotiations. 5 weeks into the strike, the leaderships of FEC and FERC announce an agreement to end the conflict. That agreement, we see the cuts reversed, but only partially at first, with the full amounts being reinvested only sometime later. By undermining the unity and the determination of the movement, the move succeeds in putting an end to the strike, with the most resilient student unions ending the strike in the seventh week. In the large part, though, because of the insistence of ASSE that in the interest of maintaining democratic control over the movement, any outcome of negotiations would have to be put to a vote in all of the student general assemblies across the province, a huge number of general assemblies eventually reject the agreement, while at the same time voting off the strike. There was a lot of anger at FEC and FERC's leaderships during and after the strike. Lots of students from all quarters of the student movement felt they squandered the students' historic mobilization ever at that time. It was the largest strike in 2005 at that time. And also, the strike made the political divide between the two poles of the student movement very obvious. FERC eventually paid a high price in between 2005 and 2007 with three very large university campuses in Quebec leaving the federation, including the very large McGill undergraduate student union. As it's often the case, when chapters of struggle come to a close, the 2005 strike left the mixed feelings of victory and defeat. Victory, for one, because the strike ever happened at all, because it grew into the largest mobilization at the time, and because its power was enough to force the government into concessions, however small. But defeat also, because the strike coalition built around ASSE wasn't enough to prevent FEC-FERC from appropriating the movement and squandering the mobilization in exchange for tiny concessions. Even though the Liberals reluctantly agreed to reinvest these amounts into student financial aid, their next move can be more clear: a hike in university tuition fees. They don't wait 5 years until 2012 to do it, though. They dropped the official announcement in 2007 with an immediate hike of 30% spread on 5 years, with a new strike and with a new hike further down the road in 2012. Unfortunately, 2007 is somewhat of a less glorious chapter than 2005 or 2012 in the student movement. ASSE takes a bold stance to launch a general strike with the demand of free tuition, no less. not more than just a handful of student unions eventually get a strike mandate that year. The failure to block the strike, the hike in 2007, was a big blow. But as the student movement in Quebec has shown, it's got an ability to evolve and learn from its mistakes. I'm not saying everyone went home just disappointed but optimistic. For sure, there was lots of finger pointing and bigger debate. I mean, we are talking about the left here. Lots of different things were highlighting as having contributed to the failure. Bad internal dynamics at SA, and not enough mobilization having been done on campuses, material not have been solid enough, and so forth. But the most significant element, however, might have been the political miscalculation of having called for a general strike on the basis of free tuition. In a way, this was a big break because we can't help but notice that the largest and most successful student struggles were giving sets of realistic and immediate goals. In 68, you had the demand for the democratization of higher education. In the 70s and 80s, students fought for adequate student financial aid and against hikes in tuition and fees and so forth. It's through these kinds of objectives that the student movement is able to mobilize and grow. Part of the success of the student movement in Quebec is based on an ability to relate to the concerns of regular students and speak to their day-to-day experience, while at the same time being able to articulate all this to wider political analysis that seeks to address the issues at their root. This leads me to the part where I want to talk to you more about combative unionism. All through the history of the Quebec student movement, the syndicalist tendency has maintained that students need to organize into unions. It was true then, and I think it's still true today. For sure, students don't form a homogenous social class like workers do. In any given campus, you'll have students with a really wealthy background, along with also students who can barely make ends meet. But despite the different socioeconomic backgrounds, students do form a community and they do share sets of common interests. And that independently of their philosophical, religious, or political opinions. Chiefly, there's the issue of accessibility to education. With tuition constantly increasing, students being pushed further and further into debt, being forced also into precarious jobs only to survive, the dream of higher education is rapidly becoming a nightmare for some students. The gap between the myth of the equality of chances and the reality of that lie is getting deeper. There's also matters of quality of education. In terms of student-teacher ratio, for example, access to appropriate study equipment, good libraries, study space, etc. There's also concern about corporate influence over the content of courses and programs, not to mention the issue of research being oriented more and more towards the needs of big businesses, while fundamental research, which in areas such as humanities, or other sciences are gradually being abandoned because they don't serve industry profits. These are all issues that can cement support for student unions. At the same time, I know a lot of different students who are deeply involved in different kinds of groups on campuses, public interest research groups, for example. I know lots of students who work in the PIRG at McGill and Concordia, for example, and they do a lot of hard work and they address important issues, and I do have lots of respect for what they do. But that kind of organizing isn't a substitute for student unions. Political groups alone can't hope to build a movement of the same nature that we've seen in Quebec, because their aim simply isn't to build unity among students. Now, of course, most campuses these days already have some kind of student-led structure. So obviously, it's not enough for students to organize into unions. There's different kinds of unions, and there's different unionisms also. The success of the student strike in Quebec this spring and throughout its history is a product of a certain kind of unionism that's called combative unionism. I assure you right there, it's not something that's dreamed up by academics or students in industrial relations departments. Combative unionism is an explicit strategy, a set of practices which are promoted by the syndicalist tendency in the student movement. In a nutshell, it calls for democratic, combative, and autonomous unions. This is what class is made of. First, combative unionism says that student unions should be run by their members and for their members, and that the only way to do that is through the practice of direct democracy. It's a clear rejection of representative democracies. Representative democracy, when disagreements or struggles are mediated by leaders who can act without a grassroots support or consultation, it's inevitably the interests of authorities that are served and not the members. The fundamental tool of direct democracy is the General Assembly, or sometimes also referred to as the General Membership Meeting. Only in General Assemblies can students voice their ideas and proposals on an equal footing, and where these voices can eventually produce collective decisions which are then binding on the union. These meetings are important because they allow students to engage directly to each other and develop capacities for debate and critical thinking. The power of executive boards is explicitly limited to implementing the decisions of these General Assemblies and also running the day-to-day operations of the union. Unions which practice combative unionism also have minimal bureaucracy. Paid employees isn't any substitute for anemic participation in committees and union structures. And instead of fixing the problem, a bureaucracy often makes it permanent. Dealings with administrations or higher authorities isn't based on the power of representation, but of delegation. Delegates have a clear mandate of which positions to defend and have no authority whatsoever to accept any sort of compromise. Information, of course, is key to a healthy democracy, so combative unions rely on alternative and autonomous media to inform their members. Whether it's through posters, leaflets, newspapers, and other methods, combative unions will use all the means at their disposal to make information available to their membership, and also, and perhaps most importantly, use these opportunities to directly engage with students and get them involved. In the same vein, transparency on all levels of the organization is made as real as possible. The second idea of combative unionism is, well, combativeness. Its militant tactics stem from an understanding that contrary to what the dominant ideology makes us think, the state isn't a neutral institution where all stakeholders have equal standing. In reality, we know the state is a tool in the hands of a business interest and is completely submitted by the power of finance. As a result, we can't ever hope to shame or convince the government into accepting student demands. That's why combative unionism, through mass mobilization and the power in numbers, seeks to build itself as a permanent counterpower to the state that can force the satisfaction of student demands. And the type of tactics it puts forth is a reflection of the unions themselves, by their members and for their members. In other words, direct action. We have to reject the notion that direct action is necessarily violent or destructive. At its core, direct action is all about the members being at the forefront of all aspects and not representatives or politicians. In the spirit of combative unionisms, though, the direct actions also need to be as much as possible mass actions. And the only way to do that is to take into account the general state of consciousness among the student mock body and their commitment to the movement. In that sense, General Assemblies need to have the larger role in debating and orienting tactics in the student movement. Combative unionism is also a refusal of confining the methods of protest to the limits of legality. This flows, of course, from the ideas about the nature of the state. If the state is a tool in the hands of the few, it's only logical that the laws of the state are also designed to protect these same people. But it doesn't make illegality into a dogma either. only that the different types of actions available to the student movement should be judged based on their own merit and their usefulness to the cause, and not whether or not they're sanctioned by the legal system. As a result of all this, combative unions will ally both common methods of protest, such as rallies, marches, and strike action, with more vigorous methods, such as occupations and blockades. The third core idea of combative unionism is about autonomy. In the interest of preventing alienation from its own organizing by and for its members, the combative unions need to promote and materialize their autonomy with regards both to the state and political groups. Autonomy first with regards to state structures, because students don't stand to gain anything significant by participating, especially when the nature of their demands contradicts the interests that control the state. This also translates into a rejection of participation in summits and consultations by the government, not least because these events are almost always used by the government to legitimize future government decisions that often run counter to the politics of the student movement. Autonomy also with regards to political groups and political parties. Any political party which includes as part of its programs certain demands of the student movement, once in power, would inevitably have to face the politics of compromise which are characteristic of the parliamentary system. As such, any political party's stance on issued from the demands of the student movement are always subject to be abandoned in the name of political realism. I think a number of historical examples confirm this. So those are the three ideas of combative unionism, which have been part of the student movement since its very inception. Hopefully, through the decades, these ideas have been enriched, and one of the ways they have is by the incorporation of feminist thought and practices. It's often apparent, whether it's in radical groups or in mass organizations such as student unions, that the voices of women aren't heard as often as the men's, or that more men tend to get involved in ways that put them under the spotlight, while the involvement of women is often much more invisible. Feminist women activists in the student movement have worked relentlessly throughout the years, often under much criticism of their men comrades, to integrate feminist analysis on student issues, but also to institutionalize feminist practices in the student movement. Today, that work is visible, for example, by the existence of women's committees in ASSE and in other student unions, the common rule of alternation between women and men speakers in all types of meetings, and the integration of teams of vibe checkers which keep tabs on tensions and hostilities during meetings, and who also call out participants when they use stereotype language. So I've told you about the history of the Quebec student movement, about the ideas of combative unionism. But of course, we're all very conscious that it's not enough to evoke all of this in the hopes of creating instant activism in the wake of the speaking tour. What the student movement and social movements at large can learn from the Quebec student movement most, I think, are from the practices our own student unions have, so that they can be adapted to local conditions and local experiences outside of Quebec. Throughout the presentation, of course, I've told you lots of about general assemblies. I wanted to just say a few things about these types of meetings. Firstly, they're not something that happens just when there's elections or where a strike vote comes up. General assemblies are regular features of many student unions in Quebec. And so, while the number of participants in these general assemblies is, of course, always subject to be fluctuate on the whether there's strike votes being taken or other campaigns or other issues being brought up in these meetings. The activists that organize in the student movement put a very strong emphasis on maintaining these general assemblies and maintaining that tradition of frequent and as populous as possible meetings such as this one. The idea, of course, of general assemblies is that anyone can bring motions to the floor and submit them to the student body, and also they can modify these proposals using rules of order, which can help structure the debate and help discussions move forward towards collective decisions. I wanted to show this picture because it illustrates what one can see when they participate in a General Assembly in a student union in Quebec. The two students that we see in front are not members of the student union, but members of another student union. One is the facilitator and another jots down the meeting notes. What you can see from this picture also is that the executive board isn't all standing in line in front of the meeting, because in general assemblies, whether it's executive boards or other members of different committees of the student unions, become regular and ordinary members with the same rights and responsibilities as any other student in the general assembly. For sure, executive boards can still have important roles in helping running student unions. They can bring motions to the floor. They can report on the student union's activities, invite other activists from other campuses or other groups to speak to the students. But when, as far as the General Assembly is concerned, they are students with the same rights as anyone else. The voting methods are also often subject of discussion. Here we see that students are voting, these two are voting in favor of the strike by a simple show of hands. Other student unions will decide to have a secret vote or sometimes hold referendum or even online voting. But the basic idea of voting mechanisms in general assemblies is that the General Assembly itself has the control over the decision-making process and the voting mechanisms. And when you have students who come to these meetings and insist on the necessity of online voting, for example, or referendums, in the name that as many students as possible can participate, it's interesting because it sparks important debates about the nature of democracy and what makes a decision truly democratic or not, whether it's simply the number of votes or the whole of the decision-making process, which can include debate and discussion beforehand and information. This is how coordination of the student movement happens. The delegates that you see around the table from different student unions across the student movement are just that, delegates. And they are not representatives who can speak on behalf of their members and take decisions without consultation of their membership. And so motions that are brought to these congresses need to have the support of general assemblies. And if these motions don't have the support of the majority of student general assemblies, then they simply can't pass. Of course, this can make the development of the decisions somewhat complex. During the strike, for example, these meetings happened in different cities across Quebec on a weekly basis, and so there's often a back and forth between general assemblies and delegates who have to take decisions in common and in accordance with their own mandates. But also other students and activists can also attend these meetings, and so in that sense, the decision-making process is made as accessible and transparent as possible. I've talked about the importance of information in combative unions. this is actually three covers of the Journal Ultimatum that was produced on a weekly basis during the student strike. And these were distributed not only massively in student protest, but also among the general public. Independent media initiatives such as Concordia University Television, which was instrumental in providing an alternative point of view into student direct actions and protests, was very important in providing a source outside of the mass media where right-wing bias would often have a large part to play in commenting and analyzing these events. Mobilization committees were also very important, but somewhat under the shadow of lots of what happened during the strike in Quebec. The idea of these mobilization committees, which would organize on different campuses or based on the different departments in universities, is that there's no formal structure, no elected capacities for these committees. It's simply a matter of setting a date and time and seeing with the students who show up what kind of projects can be made, what kind of issues can be brought up in general assemblies, and so forth. The basic idea is to network students and organize outreach to get students to attend general assemblies and actions and so forth. The mandates that are for these mobilization committees are also developed within general assemblies themselves. So in a way, those mobilization committees, while they're autonomous, they're also there's an importance that's accorded to making them connected to the larger student body through the general assembly. They're also important when, for example, building momentum towards a strike action by organizing, whether it's workshops or petitions or direct action on campus, and all leading up to more massive actions such as a strike action. Mobilization committees are also very useful, whether it's in the context of Quebec or outside. When executive boards or bureaucracy which controls student unions are hostile to mass mobilizations or hostile to direct democracy. For example, in Concordia, the Geography Mobilization Committee organized by using a bylaw in the student union that would have the executive force to convene a general assembly of the student body through a petition of 100 names. They were able to have a convene a general assembly during the strike, and they were able to make a convincing argument for joining the strike, and thus they were on strike during 6 weeks. This is the first reason why you've heard actually of the student strike outside Quebec. The idea of picket lines, of course, is that when a strike mandate is voted in, then all classes are cancelled in the CEGEP or the university departments or faculties that are concerned with the strike vote. This is actually a picture of students mounting picket lines outside a Montreal CEGEP, just as the administration threatened to use police action to break the picket lines and have classes happen that day. Of course, activists from other campuses and even non-students responded in solidarity by reinforcing the picket lines that morning, and the police action that you saw, which a snapshot of is there, was actually unsuccessful that morning, and classes were cancelled by the administration, not just for the rest of the day, but for the rest of the week. For sure, when you have very large university campuses, which are often spread on sprawling campuses with lots of different buildings, blocking access to buildings in the way that we've seen isn't always possible. And so in lots of universities in Quebec, students organized every morning with a list of classes which were to happen with the date, with the time, and room numbers, and simply organizing in small groups to either prevent any access to their classes or simply take the teacher aside and try to convince them and try to make them waste their time in a sense so that the class would have to be canceled. Or most often what happened is that the students would simply enter the class as it was about to start and not leave until the class was canceled. So in Quebec, depending on the mobilizing that's done beforehand, actually there's oftentimes very little students that just show up to their classes. Most students, when there's a very visible campaign and where the strike vote results are diffused very widely on the campus, then students, we see students eventually in most cases will respect the strike votes. But of course, there's always students who are not as as discouraged, you can say, as easily from wanting their classes. So the role of these students that go and make sure the classes are canceled is not a simply hostile move, but also these activists use these as opportunities to engage debates, discuss the issues at hand, inform students about the general assemblies, and so forth. Getting teachers on board when this happens is also something that is said to be very important, so that when a strike vote is taken and students which are not which don't have that class show up to have the class canceled, then it's a lot. Activists have realized that it's often much more difficult when the teachers themselves don't have any idea of what's going on, that there's a strike vote going, that the students are having a political campaign, etc. So something specific that happened during the student general strike was injunctions. Several students, mostly from a much more wealthy background, got court orders actually from judges that obligated the campus and university administrations to take any means necessary at their disposal, including resorting to security or police forces, to make sure that the classes of these students which got a court order would happen. Of course, the move created lots of discontent in General Assemblies, and after lots of debates, General Assemblies decided to reject the legitimacy of these court orders and defy them, even against the threat of very large fines. And in effect, they were so effective that the failure of the court orders to be effectively enforced by police were one of the reasons of Bill 78, which effectively put an end to the student strike. This is the second reason why you've heard about the student strike in Quebec. Of course, the idea is to disrupt business as usual, not only on campus, but also outside campus. So any legitimate targets were subject to be disrupted or blockaded. So you have any building in the financial district was a legitimate target. State-run institutions, such as the Montreal-run, the state-run Montreal casino. In that case, students felt it was only legitimate to deny the rich their playground while the students were struggling. The ruling party and business gatherings were also legitimate targets. This is actually a snapshot of an attempt to disrupt the Salon Plan Nord from inside. Salon Plan Nord is basically the economic initiative by the previous Liberal government to exploit northern Quebec natural resources by mining and forestry on, of course, unceded indigenous lands. And so in that particular event, police were already on the premises and literally encircling the gathering inside the room. This is another picture which I wanted to show because it shows the moment where during the Liberal Party General Congress in Quebec, that happened during the strike, activists organized to make sure that the barriers surrounding the building would be quietly pushed aside so that students could effectively all the students, but also the community and labor activists who participated in that meeting could also surround the actual building and truly attempt to disrupt in a real way the meeting and not simply be forced to sit hundreds of meters outside so that they would be totally ineffective. Also, this particular event happened outside of Montreal, and so lots of disruptions, whether it's blocking bridges, roads, other smaller government offices, that sort of stuff happened not only in Montreal, but also in all cities where student activists were present. Hitting at the economy, we're hitting at the wallets of private of business interests was a very real and legitimate way of forcing the government into concessions. And so this is a picture of blockades of the port of Montreal. This is actually pictures from two different instances where students mobilized in order to attempt to force merchandise from going in or out of the port of Montreal. What's also interesting about this picture is that you can see that it's not just a handful of isolated activists that organized and did the protest, but there was a very serious effort being made in all cases to have a massive massive numbers of students come out.
Yeah. So the top photo, the one taken from way up above, are the unions organized enough that you guys have people in skyscrapers or in helicopters taking those photos?
No, this is a photo from media. No. Assez doesn't have helicopters yet. One day, but no. often when organizing and participating in these kinds of actions, it's difficult to gauge the effect that you're having and whether the disruptions are really effective. So these are two excerpts from articles that ran during the strike. The first one, Student Strike, Montreal Presses Quebec to Intervene, the game of cat and mouse in which students and Montreal police forces are engaged in is starting to irritate the city of Montreal, enough so that Montreal public security official Claude Trudel is pressing Quebec to reach an agreement with students. And the second one, marches killing downtown economy. Students' protests now into their sixth week are having a detrimental effect on the city's economy, say merchants, truckers, business people, and city leaders. Hard figures are difficult to pin down, but the effects of blocked bridges or stores and restaurants left empty because people are avoiding downtown are tangible. It's having a huge impact, says Marc Cadieux, president of Quebec Truckers Association. Solidarity is also a very important principle of combative unionism, which I could have very easily included in the core ideas of combative unionism. The idea of the need of building bridges between different struggles, because of the need to coordinate the the different struggles against the same neoliberal policies which don't affect simply students, but affect all kinds of powerless people in society. And this was embodied in the now famous slogan of the Quebec student strike of La grève est étudiante, mais la lutte est populaire, which means it's a student strike, but a people's struggle. This is at Salon Plan Nord, the protest which I've told you a bit about. This is where indigenous rights activists met up with students during the same demonstration. And this is another picture of a labor protest in a northern Quebec town, which was the scene of a very, very lengthy lockout between aluminum factory workers and the factory owners. The labor union of the factory put out a call for solidarity during this important protest, and so student unions responded to the call and answered the call by busing in students from different towns of Quebec. So same as the history, I could have for sure told you lots more about the Quebec student strike. This sort of concludes my presentation. I hope you've enjoyed it, and I do hope also that you have questions or things that you want to discuss. So perhaps I'll invite Shane to maybe take hands, and if you want to say something, just raise your hand.
You had the three, democracy, combativity, and autonomy. And when you were describing autonomy, I was wondering you were saying that the student unions wouldn't engage with political parties or in caucuses or anything like that. And I was wondering if that would get in the way of cooperation with other groups, but then in the last couple of minutes, you sort of addressed that a little bit. So clearly there is quite a bit of cooperation between student unions and labor groups. So do those policies or ideals rub up against each other the wrong way, or how does that play out, I guess?
Well, for sure there's no clear-cut line where student unions will say, well, this project we won't accept, well, this one we will. I think the basic idea is that it has to be discussed at least and decided in general assemblies before deciding on providing, like, with who we want to ally ourselves. For sure, in terms of when we're talking about labor groups or community groups, then the solidarity is much more organic, much more natural. The autonomy I was talking about refers much more in terms of political parties and like political groups per se. So, for example, there will be a certain distrust when there's a number of activists from Marxist group who start steering the politics of the student union towards their political group's politics. So it's basically the idea is to be aware of this possibility and to try and prevent it and to prevent this sort of entrism into student organizations.
I heard there's also aside from the GAs, there's the consultants that I heard.
Sorry,
I heard there also this so decision making or consultation, but process called consultants. Is it sort of different from GAs? How does it play into the decision making?
Well, in terms of the decision making, it's simply a majority rule. So the motions that who are put to a vote need to have a majority to pass. I think lots of anarchists still feel that it's important to engage and participate in these kinds of meetings and in these this kinds of decision making, because consensus-based decision making simply can't work in a student union when you have hundreds of students who come from different backgrounds, and perhaps sometimes thousands of students. And so the emphasis is instead put on the importance of that each student who can participate in the union, and that they're informed that they have rights in regards to the union's activities, and that they take their they are in a position to take advantage of these rights, also by providing workshops that teach about the different rules of order that are used in these general assemblies, so that it's not only a portion of students who know like how you can make a proposal or how you can ask for a vote or these things are able to control a meeting, but that also as many students as possible, whether for or against the different issues at hand, can use the rules of order to make the debate progress, and that it's a tool in the hands of everyone and not just a certain part of the membership. So that sort of compensates for the interesting aspects of consensus decision making, but which aren't really applicable in the context of a mass social organization.
Okay, so I wasn't really supposed to be asking about consensus, but you know, I was reading about it, and there's general assemblies and consultants, so they're basically the same.
Well, the difference is general assemblies, the decisions of the general assemblies are binding on the union. But then outside of these assemblies, anyone can organize consultas or other kinds of meetings where they can set up their own decision making, but those decisions won't be binding on the union. That's the difference that's there.
Okay.
There was someone else raised their hand before. Oh yeah, okay. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, well please go ahead because I don't look like a student.
No, it's fine.
First of all, I just think what the Quebec students have managed to do is remarkable, and it's remarkable in North America. And I think the fact that you came to the attention of Chris Hedges, for example, is testimony to that. And so, congratulations! It's really wonderful for I think all the Occupy groups and all the resistance that there is to, you know, looking at it from the perspective here, I would say, to that corporatization agenda of the universities, of education, and so on. The question that I have is, do you have any way of gauging, or do you have any sense of the solidarity that might be with you from faculty and staff on campus?
Yeah. Very good question. It's one of the very major things that happened during the strike, which I didn't very much touch on during the presentation. But teachers and faculty did, in fact, organize support, not just symbolic support, but very concrete and real support to students. And they've done that, I think, in an interesting way. For sure, there's labor unions, there's teachers unions and faculty unions in all institutions. But the radical teachers and activists in those positions decided that they needed firstly to organize independently of the unions, because for sure from the beginning the unions were very frigid in their solidarity and very unwilling to really provide any sort of true solidarity to students. And so teachers didn't wait for their leaderships or wait for their union structures to sort of move in that direction before they organize themselves, not only on campuses, but across campuses. So they created a group that's called Prof contre la hausse, Teachers Against the Hike. And they organized not only like popular education in terms of workshops and so forth, but also they were present in student demonstrations and also student direct actions. I remember one instance where I showed a picture of a blockade of the port of Montreal. Prof contre la hausse, teachers, about a dozen of them mobilized. And when riot police would come in, they'd form a line so that in the hopes that police tactics would be somewhat tamed when faced with teachers instead of students. This didn't have always the expected effect, for sure. But I think it's a testament to the willingness of lots of teachers to organize really interesting support to students, and also by their realization that all they wanted to do couldn't be done necessarily through their labor structures, but at the same time they didn't abandon them, because I know lots of teachers tried to get donations from their labor unions. They tried to during that strike, they tried to push more radical politics in their teacher unions and so forth. And so I think by deciding to work both outside and inside the teacher and faculty unions, they were able to really make lots of progress and exhibit real solidarity.
Again, I'm not a student, but I'd like to pose a question to you and to the University of Saskatchewan students here. I'd like to know how you feel about strategy if you applied Quebec syndicalist tactics at the University of Saskatchewan among students there. What we have right now is really a shop union as far as the University of Saskatchewan Students Union, I think. It's basically controlled by the university administration, in that the president of the university student union is automatically a member of the Board of Governors. And the Board of Governors has this cone of silence that comes down, and that student union president is no longer able to properly represent his student body by reporting back what decision-making is going on at the Board of Governors, but instead must pledge loyalty to the administrative agenda. And this same sort of strategy, when this policy of cabinet solidarity, basically, at the student union came about, or at the faculty Board of Governors came about, in the student union, the president of the student union of the day, and this is about 5 years ago, determined that members of the student union executive were under the same code for the student union. Therefore, members of the student union who were elected independently, the student union executive, could not differ from the collective decision of the student body. So my question is it better at the University of Saskatchewan to work or effect change from within by indulging or in participating in student elections, or is it better to take the syndicalist model and for students to organize outside the USSU in order to effect change?
Well, I really don't want to say if students want to answer that question. Yeah,
that's actually thank you for actually bringing that up. This is an announcement actually sort of relates to that. There's another talk coming up in about a week, October 2nd. There's three members of class, two, and one is the journalist from Rebel, but he's particularly a student correspondent. Like, he's assigned to do like a student strike coverage. One of them is Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois. He was sort of framed by the mainstream media as sort of like a, you know, the leader, but you know, he's obviously can only do as much as commanded by General Assemblies. And then there's one other person whose name I forgot, but there's gonna be three speakers. It's happening October 2nd, Tuesday, and it's sort of unprofessional of me. I forgot to write down the room number, but I'm sure it's gonna be circulated all over the place this coming week. It's going to be October 2nd, Tuesday. man, I forgot time to help. I'm professional, I guess. But it's going to be in the afternoon, because they're going to be here in the afternoon. They're going to drive to Regina on the same day. So that's happening. And in 2 days after that, there's going to be a general assembly at St. Thomas College, St. Thomas Moore College cafeteria there at 7 p.m. on October 4th. So that's going to be like forum for people, the students to discuss, you know. We're going to have a discussion maybe after the talk, maybe, you know, what in terms of what's at stake here. But hopefully at the general assembly we can talk about how, as much as what, also how can we do this here at the U of S. We got to start somewhere. There was the Saskatchewan now officially has the highest tuition in Canada. And Quebec has the lowest tuition, and then they're vaulting, right? And what the heck, right? Just gotta do some.
Well, yeah. For sure, this question like is always brought up in the context of Quebec also, because for sure it's not all unions who practice the same kind of unionism, and there's also especially university unions which are run just like businesses or governments, and have such a huge complex structure, a hierarchy, and so forth. And so the question there in these unions in Quebec also is it's the same nature of question. So I think it's always you have to evaluate whether it's worth it boring from within or organizing independently. And both methods were used in the context of the Quebec student movement throughout its history. What I could say about what doesn't work is either getting a job in these student unions, running for office often isn't a very effective means of transforming the student union, especially when it's a very powerful and there's a very powerful interest that sort of control the union. And so I would say that the most effective means of starting a movement for change is by organizing independently, and not independently of the executive boards or of the leaders, and by simply addressing and engaging with other students on campus who might not be activists, who might not be very aware of what's going on. But I think by starting with rank and file organizing, that's how you can start to build a movement that can really change something. And it's not something that can be done in a single week or in a single semester, especially with very large unions. But for sure, there's no shortage of issues that can be put forward that can attract students who want to do something. So, in that sense. But one of the things also one of the points I want to make also is that the strike in Quebec, if the idea was from the get-go for let's mobilize for Charest, the Charest government, let's put the Liberals out, it would have never worked. I know that the Gabriel Nadeau-Dubois and Ethan Cox tour that's being organized is a lot centered, I think, around the idea of Stop Harper. And personally, I don't find this very surprising, since some organizers are really into the NDP. And so, I mean, that sort of plays into like the NDP's politics. But I think student activists on campuses want to really build a syndicalist tendency in the student movement, they have to start small. They have to start by addressing local issues. They have to build up gradually their politics through education, through workshops, and eventually, like, enter into long-term organizing, because that's what gets the goods in the end.
Yeah, there's no one else on the list.
Oh, okay, I was just going to, what I was going to say.
Unless I can't say.
Sam, do you want to go first?
Okay, thanks. The regarding local issues and the link between, I think, what you're doing in Quebec, and this would be information that perhaps students here at the U of S may not be aware of, but first of all, the university governing structure is a little different here, in as much as there is a Senate. It's not like the Senate at most universities. At most universities, the Senate is faculty, and they tend to be aligned with the administration very often. And so a lot of universities will have a Board of Governors and Senate that is faculty. The U of S has got three components to the governing body, and so there's the Board of Governors, then there's Faculty Council, which is representatives, of course, from the faculty, and the Senate here does have representatives from the community. And they have had the ability to bring motions forward to the Senate. It has not been an effective organization up until, I would say, a couple of years ago when we started changing that. And now there are activist members of the community who have gotten themselves elected to the University of Saskatchewan Senate. One of the issues that we are focusing on for the next meeting of Senate, which is Saturday, October the 20th, so that will be following your General Assembly on October the 4th, I think you said it was, sorry, yeah. And so you might be interested in this, and this issue is, I had not realized actually the extent of it until just this week, but we had, some people had mobilized to resist the participation of Lockheed Martin Corporation at the University of Saskatchewan. They were holding a meeting on campus in April. And for people, some people don't know who they are. They are essentially the American military. They are part of the reason that the Americans dropped bombs on Iraq illegally, because they have a great deal of influence in what happens with the Pentagon. And they are more and more coming into Canada, and they are more and more coming onto university campuses. What are called collaboration topics for research that Lockheed Martin has offered to the U of S and to other universities. You can tell that the document that they presented here is really used as a template at other universities as well. But it's obscene at how militaristic their collaboration topics are. That is coming into the University of Saskatchewan, and it was at the last Senate meeting, it was defended by the acting Dean of Engineering, who is Ernie Barber. And so what we are doing is just developing resistance big time, hopefully. We'll be able to kick them out and make sure that they aren't here. But they're moving into Saskatoon, not just at the universities, but in other ways as well. So, and that, when I say I had not realized the extent of that problem, a former student here at the University of Saskatchewan, who some of you will know, Mary Jean Handy, where she's doing her studies now in Ontario. She is a professor that she's working with. But at any rate, has a paper written. It's not yet published, but it is about that very thing: the militarization it's seeping into universities, and it's seeping in.
Sorry to interrupt, we're just running out of time. Is there
a point? Yeah, I'm sorry. I conclude my remarks there.
Thank you. Yeah. I'm wondering, in addition to the opposition to the tuition hikes, what did you find were some of the issues that really sort of resonated across sort of student bodies that you think might have traction here if they were sort of brought up in by organizers who are talking to students, that kind of thing?
Well, there's larger issues that were brought up, like once students realized, I think, their own ability to mobilize and build into such a large social movement. It really went very broad in terms of the idea of democracy itself, through living through these general assemblies and this very vivid democracy on campuses. Then, where does the government take its legitimacy from its representatives? Those are all broader issues. I think that might not be as much might not resonate as much outside, where there's more of a climate of apathy and complacency, perhaps, than there was during the spring in Quebec. So I think the best people who can identify these sort of issues are the students themselves. So it has to come from the students.
Absolutely.
I think. Yeah, but for sure, at the basis, issues of commodification of education and accessibility to education are issues that are really central in the student movement. Coming from the fact that the idea of education that's pushed by ASSE, and which is often at the core of its political discourse, is the right to free education. That education is a right, not a privilege. And that if education belongs to society, knowledge belongs to society, then no one can has the right to charge vast amounts of money for individuals to have access to that knowledge. So this element of politics has been at the root of the student movement since the 60s. So perhaps it's something that can be built on outside of Quebec as well.
We have a question here, over there.
I was just wanting to make a comment. Yesterday, I was having a conversation with somebody, with actually my uncle, one of my uncles, and I mentioned the Quebec thing. I was in Quebec this summer for the first time and loved it, and went to the August 22nd protest in Montreal. And I was mentioning I was coming to this tonight, and he said, well, why support the students anyway? And so I was like, well, okay, that's a harsh question, but I kind of just said, you know, they're obviously trying to say that they want education to be a priority in a society and that money not be a barrier to that, right? And in the end of the conversation, it sort of came to light that really his opposition is to how commonplace the university education has become, and how he says there needs to be something that sort of weeds people out so that there's not so many people going to university, because then there's no more value in a university education. So he started saying, well, then why not make it free and just make it harder to get into university? So, yeah, make it free. That's a great idea. And, yeah, people should work hard when you want to get a university education. So I noticed you talked about the failure tax thing. Can you talk a little bit more about, I guess, what are the issues of that? And, I mean, yeah, it does prevent people from getting access to an education than if they're not doing well in a class and if they also have to pay for it. But do you know what I mean? Can you just talk a little bit more about what the bad and the good of that?
Mm-hmm. Well, for sure. I think it's not such an interesting choice, I think, to have school results tied into the right of whether or not you're good enough to have that education. Mm-hmm. The thing with the failure tax is that some students, might sometimes fail classes because of a difficult personal situation, difficult financial situation. So the blunt force of these sorts of measure disproportionately affect people who come from a more difficult socioeconomic background, from backgrounds where parents don't have a university education, because oftentimes it's one of the most determining factors, I know, for Quebec
for who gets a university education is whether their parents have one. And so for sure there's a cultural aspect to whether students will be interested into a university education. But the thing is, when you compare the cost of paying for educating society as a whole, I think it's so small compared to the cost of corruption, of militarization, of all of these things that are happening, and which, like, of subsidies to private businesses and all those sorts of things, that it has to be framed in the context of what are the priorities in society, and that I think we have to reject also the notion that scarcity is what brings value to something. Water is plentiful, but everyone has access to free water.
But university is always the only career, like path to a career either, right? So I think maybe there's the idea that no other path to education matters anymore except university, when that's not true. All different kinds of education are still valid. Mm-hmm. I think that's being overlooked a lot.
Well, for sure. I think that the basic idea behind it is that the whatever choice one takes about his own education should never have anything to do with financial capacity, and should have only to do with interest and belief in their in ability to contribute something positive to society. So if people have to go through a lengthy university training to realize that what they're really good at is being a plumber, then I think it's still valid course of education.
Can I just make a point on that? I'm a teacher, and there's a huge push right now for trades for students. It's mm-hmm. huge, and in fact, that's one of the main things that there's big presentations by people from Saskatchewan apprenticeship stuff, and what they do is they actually do have a little bar graph saying this is how much a university education will cost you. And instead of the general jobs you can get and the economic range of salaries and stuff, these are trades, and you get paid while you learn a trade in apprenticeship programs, and this is the salary range that you're going to get. And these bar graphs are so disproportionate that everyone's like, I'm going into trade. Exactly. So the university thing is going to dwindle down, because it's like there's a huge concerted effort to push kids into trades, actually.
But again, that's discouraging people, though, because it's really expensive.
Well, so people are now realizing that they don't have to go to university to mm-hmm. have, like, you know,
Do you show a question, Rob?
Sure.
A while ago.
Unfortunately, he hasn't spoken purposely.
Okay. Well, I was really lucky enough to be in Quebec this summer by accident. I got to participate in some of the big manifestations. And I even got to talk to a lot of people who organized a class, the class congress, where they were, there was a big 13-hour one where they were electing all the delegates and everything else. And I guess, I'm not bilingual, but what I could understand from, like, bits of translation that people were giving me were really helpful, was that I guess there were, obviously there's, like, the sympathetic self-criticism, which, I thought the class had a really good mechanism, like, overall as an assembly, it had a really good mechanism for being able to sort of, for the students to be able to kind of steer the direction of what they were doing, and sort of also sort of criticize their own previous sort of moves or strategies, and just maybe not sufficient to whatever. And just for an example, like one of them was, I think it's because there wasn't the expectation of Anglophone participation as much as there, I guess it's been, from what I understand, it's been mostly, like, it's been less visible in previous ways of strikes among students. And one of the students was saying, well, we really kind of blew it, I think, when we didn't provide enough translation or outreach to Anglophone students. And I'm sort of wondering what sort of discussions are maybe emerging now, like about, I mean, I know that there's been this incredible victory for now, like, but what sort of discussions are kind of emerging around, like, what could have been done differently to have made it even more effective?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, my involvement in the last weeks and months of all this has been somewhat a bit removed from the from the internals of class and these congresses. But for sure, the main thing, of course, is translation of material and presence on campuses, on Anglophone campuses. So So yeah, historically, Anglophone campuses haven't been as much active as Francophone campuses in terms of syndicalist and student unionism. But for sure, there's always been students from that background who are interested in mobilizing also. And I think perhaps one of the things was missing is that class perhaps didn't have enough tools to give to these activists to help them mobilize on their own, mobilize on the, like how they saw most effectively on their in their own environment. So, but it's always difficult because there's also the matter of a union's sovereignty over its presence and its membership. So sometimes, if you have activists from other unions come into like Dawson Cégep, for example, from Cégep Saint Laurent, then it'll create tensions between the leadership of the union, who sort of like doesn't like being called out on not being so effective at like making general assemblies happen and mobilizing, and having other Francophone the Cégep students like do it in their place. So there's lots of tensions, but I think it's going to be a gradual progress, and I think in the same way that perhaps this is going to develop outside of Quebec, it's also going to develop gradually through the like long-term organizing that's done on Anglophone campuses in Quebec, and perhaps in future campaigns and struggles, Anglophones will be much more at the forefront. I don't know if it's so significant that it can be perhaps made as a sort of a making a parallel to this, but Université de Montréal was like always a very conservative campus with only a handful of the humanities student unions mobilized during these kinds of struggles. But in 2005, there was lots and lots of efforts put into mobilizing in this university, and it sort of more or less paid off in 2005. And this year, we've seen student unions like medicine, law, engineering, mathematics hold general assemblies without any like real involvement from activists from class or other student unions. So I think it's a gradual progress, and what makes why the student movement has built into what it is today is, I think, through the organizing efforts that were put, not just in moments of very intense struggle, but also the in-between moments where there's demobilization, there's like sort of less of media interest into student struggles, but where radical activists were still like organizing workshops, having people come out to general assemblies and just simply like hold it together. So that the student unions would still have these ideas and practices there when there was a huge issue that came up, such as the tuition fee hike.
I'm just wondering about sort of, you know, well, first of all, I actually want to sort of draw attention to the fact that actually the president of the student union at the U of S was quoted in Star Phoenix, which is a local paper, saying he's actually, I mean, he basically said he's in support of this, the tuition hike, or he didn't say it, but, you know, he said it in a politician way, saying, like, there's nothing we can do about it, he just want to make sure that it's done right, basically, but that means basically he supports the increase. So that's the sort of extent of, you know, the level of commitment from our leaders, I guess. And he was also elected with the support of progressive and Aboriginal community, and he's the first Indigenous. Yeah, he first, the student union president was Indigenous background, so he had a lot of support from the progressive community here, but now he's, you know, totally flipping sides, and now, you know, that's very upsetting. And then so my question is, you know, in Anglosphere, it's very different dynamics, you know, right, in terms of student politics or student unionism, so-called, you know, because CFS is very dominant, right, it's, in a more left side of perspective, but they are completely corporatist and ineffective institution. I know there was some discussion on Ontario, Toronto in particular, and, you know, but how do sort of this sort of like Anglo sphere adapt, like how do we actually respond to these different different politics, you know. It's because there's no actually the student union outside of those either CFS or other more liberal / conservative CASA. So it's almost like a two-party American politics kind of situation going on here. Right? How do we actually, you know?
Well, I think it has to start. Firstly, I think it's not. It might not be an effective strategy to start thinking about building like the Canada-wide or province-wide syndicalist student tenancy organization. I think it has to start like small on campuses, in departments, in smaller colleges, where activists can have like a hold of issues and mobilize for support. And when there's like a network of unions that are democratic or are combative and sort of have developed these sort of practices, then I think it's the appropriate time, I think, to start thinking about coordination between these unions and things like that. So I think the same applies for big university campuses. I think instead of trying to think to start to making change from the top down, I think change has to come from the bottom up. And so by starting small in department, I mean, that's how it was done in McGill and Concordia, because some departments were on strike for like a month, 2 months, and were really militant and very mobilized, with general assemblies happening every week. And that happened because students and radical activists engage not with the leaders of their student unions, either departmental or campus unions, but they started by engaging with their fellow students, firstly, and which were not necessarily radicals or activists. I think that's the most interesting starting point. And afterwards, perhaps CFS can be reformed. Perhaps it has to be completely put aside. I mean, that. The two options may be possible. I am not one to be able to say which, but I think through organizing, through building strong local unions with strong democracy and commitment to like combative militancy, then I think it'll only flow naturally that other overarching organizations which can coordinate in a fashion that corresponds to the nature of these student unions will emerge.
I think, Cole, I think your last question is kind of similar to your first question in terms of like where do we go from here? Like what after the presentation? Like what is next? Like even though we have the student union here, it's not very helpful. Both of my degrees, the first one was at Queens and the second was here. As much as I was involved in politics that was going on, none of it was within the student union. When I was at Queens, so this, what you're talking about now, is very new to me. So, first, thanks for coming, and second of all, it'd be really great if even just it looked like you were reading from stuff that had been typed up, if a copy of that could be left behind, or a few copies of that could be left behind. I think it'd be great because of what Rob brought up with the translation issue, for those of us who want to sort of skim it, peruse it, or look more in depth later on, that'd be great.
We did bring two, I think, interesting documents that basically sort of sums up like the talk tonight and the ideas about like democracy and combativeness. Mm-hmm. One is a document that's called "Why Should We Strike? Some Answers for Students." That was put out by radical activists, I think, in Anglophone universities in Montreal, and it sort of touches on a whole wide array of subjects, from history to how can we, like, how should we start, how do we organize a mobilization committee. So it's more of a Q&A. And there's also one newspaper that was put out by CLAF during the student strike, a copy of Ultimatum, publication of Ultimatum, which is entirely in English. and it also touches on the same subjects of practices in student unions and also the politics surrounding student issues also. So, and those are free free documents, so feel free to pick them up on our table on your way out.
The thing that did help me out a lot when I was doing my undergraduate degree the first few years was the PIRG. That's something that we don't have at the University of Saskatchewan right now, and I guess they're lucky to have it in Regina. It was very helpful in terms of just it was a great place for me to sort of expand my awareness of issues overall. And when we wanted to actually take action, whether it was specifically on campus or on university issues or on broader community or global issues, there was a place for us to get funding from. There was an office to meet at, things like that. So, Koro, or I think you as well, a place for like a starting point. That is another one. People have been talking for over a year now, as far as I know, about trying to get the students at the USSU to vote in favor of creating a PIRG here, and that might be a place, a rallying point for not just the PIRG's actions, but also for creating a stronger student union or a new and different, more radical student union as well. And just about your point about the universities, it took me 6 years of education in English literature to find out the best way to run a coffee shop. I guess I could have taken a year of business management and gotten right into that business right away, but I would have ended up managing a very different kind of coffee shop.
No. I think it's definitely very important. I just think that, like the comment about encouraging students from high school to go and do trades just because a university degree is expensive, that's not the right way. But to also just encourage everybody to go to university when maybe that's not the way they learn is also, like, problematic. So, I mean, I kind of get a little bit of what my uncle is trying to say. I don't agree with him, and that I really think money needs to not be a barrier and not be a factor in somebody's decision of what they want to study. If, like, I didn't have help in paying for some of my education, which I'm going to stop doing now until I can actually repay my debt, because I don't feel I should get another degree until I can actually pay back the money I borrowed, but I did have help so that I could get that first degree, and I didn't have to think about, okay, what am I going to study in terms of what's going to make me money back? I wouldn't have studied language and linguistics if I was only thinking about how am I going to pay for my degree, right? And I think that shouldn't be a factor. So I agree that it really needs to be accessible, but it's also not the only way to educate yourself. And maybe everybody doesn't learn like that, right?
I think one of the ways that I say in class build support for opposition to the tuition fee hike is by sort of explaining to the general public and to students that someone who gets a university degree, like a university degree, isn't simply a personal and individual investment, because that's how it's presented to us. Like, you borrow, you learn, and then you make money. You're a private business, you know, with a bottom line and everything. And instead, that anyone who gets a university and an education, whether it's in trade or university, that has value for the collectivity at large. And in when it's framed in that sense, I think it's very different.
I thought that was really good. You were speaking, I guess it was a few hours ago now, about the responsibility of the individual, or the responsibility of the intellectual, and the rights of the student. So that framed that pretty well.
Oh, well, I just wanted to add on
there
that the principles of the university is not only to educate one in perspective for future jobs, but the very basic principles of a university is to form citizens into critical thought, and I mean that's what we're slowly turning away from, that kind of institution into a factory that pumps out workers, and it's pretty obvious what the social programs are like. I mean, sociology, political science, the programs that don't really bring much money to corporate interests are being slowly pushed aside, and there's a big lack of investment. So I can understand as much as your uncle being it's not the only way of having people. Like, I studied at a trade school. I'm a welder by trade, but I was pushed into it, and I would have really enjoyed going to university to develop or at an earlier stage a critical way of thinking and that kind of stuff.
Is there any more questions?
Coming to the assembly on this Thursday, 7 p.m. at SDM cafeteria. So.
Thank you guys all for coming and sticking around so late.